Nothing's certain in politics, but professionals know one thing. Subscribing to the Cook Political Report is the right decision in every election cycle.
For more than four decades, the Cook Political Report has been providing political professionals with the right analysis to help them invest political capital with confidence.
A deep knowledge of the past, combined with a meticulous, unbiased analysis of the present, produces the most accurate predictions of the future, time and time again.
Because it's all backed by data from every input that decides elections for president, Congress, and governorships.
Subscribers to the Cook Political Report get the clarity they need through smart analysis that you won't get anywhere else.
Like the very latest outlook for every race and access to our analysts. Amy Walter, David Wasserman, Carrie Dan, Jessica Taylor, Aaron Covey, and Matthew Klein.
The Cook Political Report offers
the right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
For getting it right.
Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Hello and welcome to The Uggers. I'm Amy Walter. We took a late summer break, but we're back with a new slate of really great interviews. Now, when we started this year, redistricting was not something we thought would be driving our politics this cycle. But of course, that's no longer the case, with Texas unleashing a domino effect of redistricting efforts across the country. Thankfully, someone I know really well, and you probably do too, the Cook Political Report's very own David Wasserman, is here to help. If you follow Dave on X, otherwise known as Twitter, you know him as Redistrict. Redistricting itself is a topic Dave has been fascinated with for a very long time. He was literally poring over maps and congressional data as a kid, which we talk about in this conversation. It's pretty adorable. Now, as one of the most trusted sources in the country on congressional maps, I literally can't think of anyone better to help us navigate this complicated and unprecedented mid-cycle redrawing of districts. We recorded this conversation on Thursday, September 11th. Hey, Dave. Great to see you.
Hey, Amy.
So before we get into sort of the current back and forth over this unprecedented redistricting that we're seeing across the country, I want to talk about you for a minute. You're, I would say, and I think a lot of people would agree with me, preeminent expert on this subject of redistricting. So can we have a little backstory? Like, how did David Wasserman get interested in this? I mean, you do have a Twitter handle that is at redistrict.
Yeah, which isn't getting as much use as it once did. X has changed a little bit.
Yeah. But
I actually fell in love with maps before I fell in love with politics. I remember in kindergarten and first grade being fascinated with, you know, where roads went. And I started studying street atlases. And then I, you know, studied, world geography. And by sixth grade, I was really gung-ho about the geography bee.
Did you ever participate in a geography bee, Dave?
Oh, yeah. I was the three-year Montgomery High School geography bee champion.
Fantastic.
Although I wasn't smart enough to get to the nationals, but at least I was able to merge that passion with politics when that kind of came online in sixth grade. And I started watching C-SPAN because I think for a couple of weeks there was a glitch in our cable TV system and we only got two channels. We got QVC and C-SPAN. And so I got really bored of QVC. I switched over and I started writing down the names and states and districts of everyone I would see speaking on the floor of the House. I've always been a compulsive list maker. So I was curious, where do these people come from? How do they get elected? I started going to the library and I discovered this book called The Almanac of American Politics. And I couldn't check it out because it was a reference book, but I could sit there in the reference section and read it. And I was looking at these congressional district maps and wondering, how did these districts get their shape? So that ignited the love affair that I've carried with me to this day.
And when you were doing all of this, Dave, I don't want to age you too much, but this is before the era of Google. Talk a little bit about how you've been able to follow, as redistricting has gotten more sophisticated in some ways, thanks to the technology, how you've been able to follow through with that as well.
You know, the evolution of redistricting technology is pretty staggering, because I remember in 2001, maybe reaching out to one of the software purveyors for the tools that a lot of map makers who do this professionally use in order to draw district lines. And I remember getting kind of like a sample program that had half the functionality. And by 2005, I was able to use that to help with a thesis that I wrote in college on gerrymandering. And yet it was painstaking. Mm-hmm. And then by the next redistricting round in 2011, 2012, something called Dave's Redistricting App came out, and it was one of several web-based programs that were available to the public to create their own districts. And that really opened up the redistricting process to a lot of casual observers and activists who wanted to influence the map making in their own states. Of course, I don't think the process in most states is truly open to the public, but it has allowed more light to be shed on what's happening. At the same time, I think there is a misconception about how we've gotten to this place of extreme gerrymandering. The conventional wisdom has been that advances in software technology and micro-targeting have allowed for parties to draw even more effective maps. In reality, when I talk to some of the graybeards who have been involved in redistricting since the 70s or 80s, the technology has gotten faster, but it hasn't really changed the mapmaker's ability to draw districts with precision. If you go back and look at some of the districts from the early 90s, they were ink blots. They were much more crazily configured,
sort of grotesquely drawn,
right? Yeah. Than many of the districts that exist now. It just took longer to construct. I think what's really changed in the time since that has allowed for more effective maps is the pre-sorting of the American electorate into like-minded places, which has made it much easier to parcel voters into heavily red, heavily blue districts. If you were to imagine a state where every precinct was 50-50, it would be impossible to draw a map that gave either party an advantage. But now that we have a lot of precincts that are 70-30 or 80-20, it's much easier for map makers to pack and crack the other side's voters.
Such an important point, because the idea that folks are drawing these lines in a more sophisticated way takes away from the fact that 20, 30, 40 years ago, it's not that the lines were unpredictable, it's that voters were a little more unpredictable, that they could be supporting a Democratic candidate, Republican candidate more freely than they are now. Well, let's switch gears and talk about where we are now. And let's just start at a 30,000 foot view, Dave, and kind of lay the groundwork. How many states are involved in this? And how many do you think will be ultimately successful?
It could be up to a dozen that reconsider maps, but at the end of the day, I'd be surprised if more than a half dozen maps change by the 2026 midterms. Now, this is unprecedented in several ways. The first is, whereas in previous mid-decade redraws, we saw states replace court-drawn maps with legislative and more partisan maps. For example, Texas in 2004. We saw New York Democrats enact a new map in 2024. This time around, we're seeing states consider replacing existing gerrymanders with even more aggressive gerrymanders. And that is true in Texas. It could be true in Maryland and Florida. And we're seeing states consider setting aside independent commissions or processes that have been approved by voters in favor of more partisan and retaliatory maps, California being the prime example of that. The other way that this is different is that we're seeing all these states consider doing this at once. It's a free-for-all. It has the potential to be a gerrymandering apocalypse that we've all feared. for quite some time, where every party's just trying to maximize their gains to the point where it would seem like we're on the verge of extinction of red state Democrats and blue state Republicans. But realistically, I think that the two biggest variables here are California and Florida.
So let's talk about that for a minute. California, in some ways, this is a much riskier proposition because this is not just a legislative process. This is putting up a vote of the California public, basically a pause on the Independent Redistricting Commission, allowing for a very partisan gerrymander up until 2030, when the Independent Commission would go back into service. Dave, based on what you know right now, how likely is it that California voters pass this?
I think it's more likely than not.
Yeah.
And, you know, Democrats will move heaven and earth to try and approve this by framing it as a way to preserve democracy by retaliating against what Trump has pressured Republicans in Texas and other states to do. At the same time, there is a robust opposition campaign that is reminding voters that they themselves passed this commission by a 61-39 margin back in 2010. We don't have a lot of public data, polling data on where this stands, and a lot depends on the framing.
Yeah.
There was a poll that cast it as that posed the question of voters of whether they wanted the legislature to take over the process or whether they wanted to preserve an independent commission. And by 64-36, according to that Citroen Center and Politico poll, of course, voters wanted to preserve an independent commission. But Democratic advertising is framing it in more partisan terms, and California is still a state that has voted against Donald Trump by 20 points twice.
That's exactly right. This is going to be framed as an anti-Trump agenda more than a redistricting agenda, right? That the framework will not really be as much about we're redrawing lines as much as it will be this is our opportunity to show Donald Trump that he can't quote unquote rig an election. And here's a way you, California voter, especially California voter who already doesn't like Donald Trump, can help preserve democracy. And then Florida, you've noted this previously. This is really one of the big question marks still out there. Obviously, it's a state with a Republican governor, Republican legislature, and a Republican Supreme Court that is likely to be willing to go along with what the legislature may pass. But even then, Dave, you're skeptical that you can squeeze much more out of the state.
At least not without resorting to some really ugly looking maps. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go back to 2021, Republican legislative leaders in Florida took an approach that wasn't all that aggressive at first. And then it was Governor DeSantis that raised constitutional concerns about a plurality black district in North Florida, then held by Democrat Al Lawson, that ended up pressuring Republicans in Tallahassee to pursue a 20-8 map. Now, at the time, that seemed quite aggressive. And now political conditions have overtaken the Republicans' wildest dreams in both Texas and Florida, given that Trump was able to expand his margin there in both states substantially to 14 points. And it's meant that Republicans do have even more leeway to go after Democratic seats. I think the two most obvious places are in Orlando, where it would be fairly straightforward for Republicans to combine Maxwell Frost and Darren Soto into one hyper blue district and then make the surrounding seats still pretty reliably Republican. And then in South Florida, where Republicans could try and take the reddest parts of the three South Florida Democrats districts, Jared Moskowitz, Lois Frankel, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Even so, keep in mind, there were two special elections in Florida in April for vacant seats that Republicans underperformed the Trump-Harris margin by more than 15 points. I don't think any Republican incumbent in Florida is going to want to see the Trump margin in their district substantially diminished given those results heading into 2026, which is why I'm skeptical Republicans could go after, for example, Kathy Castor in the Tampa Bay area, or even more Democratic seats in South Florida.
That raises such a good point, Dave, because a lot of the conversation that we're having about just how Republican or Democratic these districts are is based on one data point, and that's the 2024 election. But that assumes that that is the norm going forward. And I'd love to get your take on, you know, thinking through these maps, the risks that are being taken in assuming that one election should be the standard for what and how these districts will look 2 years from now, 4 years from now.
That's right. And one advantage for a party revisiting a map in the middle of the decade is that they can kind of update the map to reflect what the political conditions at the time are. Texas Republicans would have been much more aggressive in 2021 had they known that the state would shift right in 2024. But hindsight is always 20/20. And in Ohio, where voters approved a constitutional amendment to place limits on gerrymandering, one of the provisions that Republicans wanted included when it went to voters in 2018 was that if a map didn't pass with bipartisan support, it was only valid for 4 years. At the time, that, you know, it seemed to at least the media in the state like some kind of penalty. In reality, Republicans were well aware that there wasn't going to be broad bipartisan agreement on how to draw congressional or legislative maps. And as a result, it would give them the opportunity to revisit the map 4 years down the road. One of the things Republicans in Ohio did was they successfully added party labels to state Supreme Court races. And whereas in past decades, Democrats were able to win state Supreme Court seats because party labels were not on the ballot, now that there's much more straight ticket voting and Ohio has become such a pro-Trump state, Republicans are routinely winning those judicial elections. And as a result, the Ohio Supreme Court has veered right. It has been less likely to police partisan gerrymandering. And so Republicans are emboldened to go after seats held by Marcy Kaptur and Amelia Sykes.
A quick break, and we'll be back with Dave Wasserman. If you want to stay up to date on all redistricting news, check out our new redistricting tracker. We'll be continually updating it as we get news of midterm redistricting in states. The CPR redistricting tracker is only available to Cook Political Report subscribers, so consider subscribing today. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. The offer is available only to new subscribers. Not all Supreme Courts are built equally, or they don't all perform equally. I think there were a lot of Democrats who assumed that when, for example, Democrats took the majority on the state Supreme Court in Wisconsin, that it would allow for redrawing of the maps there to potentially help Democrats in the state of Wisconsin. They call it liberal. Majority said, nah, we don't really think they're standing here for this. That didn't happen, as you note, in Ohio or in North Carolina.
That's right. And in most states, we've seen partisan polarization extend to the highest levels of the state judiciary. Now, in Wisconsin, the most recent liberal elected to the state, or the second most recent liberal to be elected, recused herself from the congressional case because she had openly campaigned on the issue leading up to her election. I'm not sure how long that reluctance is going to last. There was an additional liberal elected to the Supreme Court to to preserve that liberal majority. But what I find interesting is how the parties can advocate for one kind of map in one state and a different kind of map in another. For example, in Wisconsin, there are currently 6 Republicans and 2 Democrats, but it's a pretty evenly divided state. Democrats make the case that there should be 2 additional Democratic districts, that it should be 4-4. Well, if you're going to achieve that, you pretty much need to divide the cities of Milwaukee and Madison so that there's more than one Democratic congressional district in those metro areas. And that would violate, you know, traditional notions of compactness in most states. In Utah, Democrats are advocating for Salt Lake City not to be cracked in 4 directions, for there to be one district that's winnable for a Democrat. And that could happen as a result of a state court ruling that has forced the legislature to implement a new map for 2026 that keeps the Salt Lake County area a little bit more compact. And it remains to be seen whether that's a Democratic-leaning district or a more competitive district.
There are also some interesting wild cards out there, Dave, in a state like Missouri, for example. Again, Republican supermajority, Republican governor, they're passing this map. But there's also a provision in Missouri law that gives opponents of legislation, I think, 90 days to collect signatures to put the issue on the ballot in front of voters. And so even if this were to pass, it's not a guarantee that there would be a new Missouri map. Is that right?
That's right. And given the exorbitant attention to this issue, I don't know that it would be that hard
to get for
opponents of this map to collect the 105,000 petition signatures that are necessary to put this on the ballot in Missouri. And so sometimes the best laid plans of partisan legislative leaders, and in this case, the president, can run into some technical obstacles or legal or ballot initiative obstacles to getting their way. New York Democrats thought in 2021 that they'd be able to pass a map that eliminated most Republican seats in that state. And the state Supreme Court objected, and the issue went to a special court-appointed master. And likewise, in Kansas, there's talk of Republicans trying to eliminate Sharice Davids from the 3rd District by making that district a lot redder. But they would not only need to overcome Governor Laura Kelly's veto, they would need it to pass muster with the state Supreme Court, which is not as conservative as the legislature in Topeka. And then in Maryland, where Democrats were blocked by a lower court in 2022 from implementing a plan that could have led to the loss of the only Republican in the state, Andy Harris, Democrats have nothing to lose by attempting an 8-0 map again. But 5 of the 7 justices on the state Supreme Court were appointed by Republican Governor Larry Hogan. Is that going to come to pass? So even in these very lopsided states, there are hurdles.
Right. That is a really important point. And while we're on the issue of courts, you have also done a lot of work looking at the role the Supreme Court has played, especially in interpretations of the Voting Rights Act. And there is litigation right now in front of the court that could significantly impact the way that the Voting Rights Act is interpreted when it comes to redrawing these lines. Can you help us understand what's at stake and what could happen depending on their ruling in this case?
Yeah, there's a lot at stake here. And the Supreme Court has really dealt with redistricting in 2 different lanes over the years. There's been the partisan gerrymandering lane, which in the 2019 case of Rucho v. Common Cause, the Supreme Court finally kind of put an end to litigation in that realm by saying you can't bring partisan gerrymandering claims in federal court. Of course, that has shifted a lot of those claims to state courts, but still at the federal level, that has emboldened parties to pursue partisan gerrymanders and be open about it because of what the Supreme Court has said. Then in the racial lane, the racial gerrymandering lane, the Supreme Court has really struggled for decades to identify what's permissible and what's not. There's no clear bright line standard for what constitutes a racial gerrymander. Now, we've seen this push and pull in previous decades. In the late 80s, the Supreme Court ruled in Thornburg v. Jingles that there is a three-pronged test to determine whether a majority-minority district should be drawn. And that led to the proliferation of a lot of Black majority districts in the South and Hispanic majority districts in the early 1990s after that census. And then, because so many of those districts were drawn in ways that seemed to defy contiguity, much like Michael Jordan defied gravity, the Supreme Court in Shaw v. Reno went back and said, look, this is the definition of obscenity. And too many of these districts have been drawn using race as the predominant factor, as an excessive factor. And so that led to the unpacking of some of those districts, including in Louisiana at that time. Now, we're kind of in this cycle again, where in Merrill v. Milligan, the Supreme Court basically upheld the Jingles test from the late 80s and interpreted it to mean that there should be additional Black majority seats drawn in Alabama. And then that ruling led to an additional seat in Louisiana as well. But Republicans in Baton Rouge, they, I think, purposefully drew an additional Black majority district that was more unsightly than it needed to be, to then be able to bring a claim that the map predominantly or excessively used race as a consideration. I wouldn't be surprised if the Supreme Court strikes down the Louisiana map, which would lead to perhaps the restoration of an additional Republican seat for 2026. But I think it would be up to other federal courts to then interpret how that should be applied in other states with majority Black districts.
All right. So bottom line, when all is said and done, given all of these caveats that you have done a really wonderful job outlining, one, how many seats do Republicans ultimately net from this process, if any? And two, how impactful will it be on determining who controls Congress in 27?
Yeah, I think it could be quite impactful. And the median outcome, in my estimation, would be a Republican gain between 5 and 8 seats.
Okay.
And let's say that Texas and California cancel out. Republicans could squeeze an additional seat out of Missouri, Indiana, perhaps 2 additional seats out of Florida. And then it really comes down to, can Democrats offset some of that in other places? Does Utah result in an additional Democratic opportunity? Does Maryland? And then, you know, there are other states that are at a lower likelihood of redrawing. And, you know, once you factor in Ohio into that calculation,
right.
That's how I get to 5 to 8. But let's say that California voters narrowly reject the ballot initiative, then that could send Republican gains into somewhere in the 8 to 12 range. And that's what that higher end of the range is really what would give me a lot of pause about calling Democrats the favorites in the House in 2026.
Yep.
It would really require Democrats to venture deeper into the lean and likely columns in our ratings. And keep in mind that even though about a third of House districts could change, two-thirds of congressional districts aren't going to change shapes in advance of 2026. We're still going to have plenty of competitive seats in Arizona, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania. These are the types of places that are going to decide the House outcome. And I think there are a bunch of districts that are not really visible in the battleground at the moment, that we could see some polling in early 2026 that surprises us and forces us to shift those ratings, depending on you know, how Trump's approval rating is faring, and you know, especially once we know the results of this November's elections.
Yeah, and what the economy is doing. I mean, Dave, you made an analogy the other day that is a very good one. If you think about, you know, a midterm election for the party in power, they know they have to shore up their defenses. And if you think about it as preparing for a storm, they try to put as many sandbags as possible in front of their home, you know, or whatever, to in front of their majority to protect it. And, you know, how high those sandbags go, again, is determined by how many more seats they can put into the safe category. Some of the sandbags, too, could be, you know, look, we're protecting our majority because, oh, the president got more popular, or the economy is actually in better shape, or there's another issue that changed the political landscape that we weren't talking about at this point as we're talking today, much like the Dobbs decision impacted what the political environment looked like. So I'm with you that, you know, the political environment is the political environment, and that has the biggest impact, because if things are going very poorly for the president and Republicans in 2026, yes, having a cushion, having to defend, having a majority of 9 seats, let's say, instead of just 3, is helpful, but it doesn't make a New Jersey district or a Michigan district or an Arizona district safer for Republicans, right? They're still going to have to win those swing seats, even as they get the extra cushion of a red district. Just to end this maybe on a more philosophical note, existential question, Dave, thinking about where things go from here. Now, there are a lot of people that say, all right, well, I guess now this is the new norm, that every 2 years, based on what what legislators see as a possible opportunity for them, they're going to try to find ways to go in and reopen redistricting. Or states that currently have constitutional amendments, like Virginia or Colorado, are going to go to voters to overturn those and allow for more partisan gerrymandering. I'm curious whether you think that is the case.
I think it could be the case as long as we are in this era of existential politics and elections, yeah, where increasingly for both parties, the ends justify the means. But I have to imagine that we reach a point of exhaustion where legislators, both in Congress and in state capitals, ask themselves, what am I doing here if the only thing that we're really contemplating in these special sessions is how our district lines are going to be drawn? I mean, it almost becomes this meta level of absurdity. And we tend to forget that Congress has the power to regulate the election of its members. It could specify that members have to be elected from districts that are only drawn once every 10 years or drawn by independent commissions. Now, I don't think Congress is going to be pursuing that avenue anytime soon. But the fact that we're focused so much on process and we're arguing over boundaries to the extent we are, and that it's become such an arms race, has the potential to dissuade a lot of people from pursuing elective office to begin with. And at what point do we reach a breaking point?
Well, Dave, thank you. That was very well said. It's been a fantastic conversation. We have a lot more twists and turns to come, and obviously, you're going to be on top of all of it. So thanks for having this conversation.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman.